thank you so much for being here. This is an honor. I followed your work for a while.
My pleasure, Alec. I'm glad you're joining you today.
It's going to be an incredible chat. And shout out to Mark Gober for introducing us too. That was amazing. And Mark's an incredible guy.
Yes. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. I'm assuming you've listened to his podcast series, Where Is Your Mind, where he featured you quite a bit.
Yes. Fantastic. Yeah.
It was amazing. It was so amazing. So I think to start, I'd like to just ask you how you got into researching near-death experiences.
Well, I came through the back door, sort of. I was raised in a scientific household where there was never any talk about anything spiritual or non-physical. We had no religious or spiritual tradition in our family. So I went through college and medical school with the idea that the physical world is all there is. And after I finished medical school, I went to psychiatric training. And in one of my first weeks as a psychiatric trainee, I was called to the emergency room to see a patient who had overdosed. And she was unconscious when I went to see her. And her roommate had brought her in and was waiting to see me down the hall. So I went down the hall about 50 yards, talked to the roommate for about 15, 20 minutes, then came back to see the patient, and she was still unconscious. So we admitted her to the intensive care unit overnight. And when I went to see her the next day, I introduced myself, and she said, "I know who you are. I remember you from last night." But that kind of threw me. So I said, "Well, I thought you were out cold when I saw you last night." And she said, "Yeah, not in my room. I saw you talking to Susan down the hall." And that kind of blew me away. I didn't know what she was talking about. She saw that I was confused and then went on to tell me about the conversation I had with her roommate, including everything I said, everything Susan said, and even what I was wearing. So I didn't know what to make of that. I thought, this can't be real. Someone's playing a trick on me. Maybe the nurses are colluding with her. I couldn't understand it. But I was there to deal with her confusion, not mine. So I kind of pushed it in the back of my mind and dealt with her. But I never forgot that. And I thought, I need to understand this. But I didn't know what to make of it. This is back in the early 70s when no one had ever heard of near-death experiences. Several years later, Raymond Moody, who wrote a book called Life After Life that gave us the name near-death experience and told us what they were like, he came to the University of Virginia where I was then teaching, and he had just written a book, Life After Life, and we were talking about it, and he described what these things were like. And I realized that's what this patient was talking about years ago. And I thought, well, it's not just a crazy psychiatric patient. This happens to normal people. I still couldn't understand it, but I thought, well, I've got to understand this. I'm a scientist. I can't walk away from things that don't make sense. I need to walk towards them. So I started collecting cases of people who had come close to death or been pronounced dead and then told these stories about things that they had seen and heard when they were, quote, unconscious. And now 50 years later, I'm still trying to understand it.
Incredible. Incredible. So can you just give me a high-level overview of the statistics you've compiled in your journey and your exploration research on near-death experiences? Just a high-level overview on those.
Sure. We talked to thousands of people, and there are people all over the world that are doing this similar research and talk to other thousands. And generally speaking, we find that about 10 to 15% of people who are documented to be close to death, things that are where they have their hearts stop, will report a near-death experience. And that comes out to about 5% of the general population. So one out of every 20 people has had a near-death experience or NDE. That's a tremendous amount of people. It's not everybody, but it's a huge amount. And what's impressive to me as a psychiatrist is not the experience itself, which is mind-blowing by itself, but more important is how it changes people's lives. I've talked to people in their 80s and 90s who had an experience as children or teenagers who say, it's never been the same. You know, I can't forget what happened. It's like it happened yesterday, and my life has never been the same again.
Incredible. And so prior to exploring near-death experiences, could you remind me again of the type of household you grew up in and how your religious / spiritual leanings?
We really had none. My father was a chemist, and his world was the physical world. That's all there was. So it never occurred to me to think about something else. I knew there were my friends who had gone to church, and I thought that was all nonsense. There's nothing that's not in the physical world. I just thought, well, it's people's imagination. And that's how I grew up until I was faced with evidence I couldn't deny that people were seeing and hearing things that were not in the physical realm.
And what are some of those things that people experienced that really stood out to you, aside from your initial experience, which in and of itself is pretty incredible? That would blow my mind.
That first initial experience, even though it happened to me, I don't trust it because I didn't know anything about near-death experiences at the time. I was a green intern. I didn't know what I was doing. I was kind of flustered. I didn't have the mindset to study that experience in any rigorous way. So it's possible that I missed a lot of stuff or I may be misremembering stuff. So I don't trust that experience. I've talked to many, many people now in the thousands who have had documented close brushes with death or been pronounced dead and yet saw and heard things that they shouldn't have been able to. Let me give you an example of that. One fellow, Al, was in his 50s and he was a driver. He was on his rounds delivering things when he had a sudden chest pain and he drove himself to the emergency room and he was evaluated and found to have blockages to vessels around his heart. He was rushed to the emergency room for emergency quadruple bypass surgery. And he told me that in that surgery, in the middle of the surgery, he left his body. He was totally anesthetized. And he looked down and he saw the surgeons with his heart opened, operating on his heart. And he said the main surgeon was flapping his arms like he was trying to fly. And he demonstrated for me. And it was hard for me not to laugh when he said that. I'd been a doctor for 30 years at that point, and I couldn't imagine a doctor actually doing this. So I said to Al, you know, I think that was probably a hallucination because of the anesthesia. He said, no. You talk to my surgeon and ask him about this. So I did. And the surgeon said, yes, I do that. I'd never seen anyone else do it, but, you know, I let my assistant start the procedure while I put on my sterile gown and gloves. And then I walk into the operating room and I watch them. I supervise them first. And to avoid touching anything with my hands that might be not in the sterile field, I put them flat against my chest where I know they won't touch anything. And I point out things to them using my elbows. And he moved around just the way Al had told me. And he said, how did you know about this? I said, well, Al told me. Now, that really stunned me. It didn't stun the surgeon. He had actually been raised in a Buddhist household in Japan. And he said, oh, yeah, we know that stuff. So I've heard lots and lots of cases like this where people had documented unconsciousness and maybe the heart stopping, and yet were able to see and hear things that they shouldn't have heard or seen. Even more remarkable to me are people who, in their near-death experience, claim to see deceased loved ones who they didn't know had died. Now, lots of people in a near-death experience claim to see deceased individuals, and that has often been dismissed as wishful thinking, expectation, and so forth. But there are a number of well-documented cases, and I've studied some myself, in which the person sees and communicates with a deceased person that was not yet known to have died. And I don't know how to explain that. That can't be expectation or wishful thinking.
Incredible. Incredible. You brought up a really important point there as it pertains to people who have lost consciousness and they verify that they've lost consciousness and that there's no brain activity.
Yeah.
Because one of the common rebuttals that I've seen, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, is that this is all a product of the brain. This is all a product of chemistry inside the brain. It has nothing to do with anything in the realm of metaphysics or spirituality, or gives no indication that we are truly experiencing something after dying. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I understand that viewpoint. That's how I was raised. And when I started studying near-death phenomena, I assumed that in a few years I would find the simple physiological explanation and be able to move beyond them. But the more we studied it, the more confusing they became. We studied all the typical things that are mentioned by my materialist, which I was: lack of oxygen to the brain, drugs given to patients, abnormal EEG activity. And every one of these hypotheses, when we tested them, turned out to be not true. For example, people who come close to death and have a near-death experience actually have better oxygen supply than those people who came close to death and did not have an NDE.
Wow.
And likewise, people who are given more drugs during their brush with death tend to have fewer near-death experiences, not more. It goes on and on. We've tested one hypothesis after another and cannot find anything that will explain near-death experiences. Beyond that, there are these phenomena that couldn't be explained by brain activity, like communicating meaningfully with deceased individuals who were not yet known to have died, and seeing things that were not within your normal range of vision, even if you had been awake, which they usually were not. And I don't know how to explain those things.
Well, that is a rebuttal to the next point that I was about to bring up, which is I've heard some people who are staunch skeptics of consciousness and life after death and near-death experience and things like this say something to the effect of, well, yes, maybe we can't measure it with modern equipment. Maybe that, yeah, there's no brain activity that we can measure, but it could be some unmeasurable amount of brain activity that is producing these phenomena. So I think you just nailed that one, yeah. Though.
Well, you know, they say there's some residual brain activity somewhere that we can't measure. But in fact, those same scientists will say that the part of the brain that's associated with higher consciousness is the very easily measurable part of the cortex that is easily measured by EEGs. So if you're looking for some deeper brain activity that can't be measured by the EEG, that's not the part of the brain that's associated with consciousness.
What are some of the commonalities amongst near-death experiences across culture and across age groups?
That's a good question, Ella, because we do find that we see the same types of near-death experiences in every society where we've looked. And in fact, if you look back through the ages, you see the same experiences being reported from ancient Greece and Rome before Christianity. So it's not a religious phenomenon. However, let me say that most near-death experiencers say that there are no words to describe what happened to them. It's just beyond our language. And then we say, great, tell me about it, you know? So we kind of force them to use metaphors to describe what happened. And the metaphors they use are going to be culturally based, things that they're familiar with, which are sometimes religiously based. So, for example, people all over the world will talk about confronting a warm, loving being of light. And Americans might say that that was God or that was Jesus, whereas people from India or from China will not use those terms necessarily. And even those who are here will say, I'm going to call this God so you know what I'm talking about. But it's not like the God I was taught about in church. It's totally different. It's much bigger than that.
Right.
So they're just using these metaphors.
Amazing. Amazing. And some of the other commonalities that I've come across, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them, is the feelings of unity, tunnel of light, life review, like you said, meeting beings, and then venturing into realms beyond the physical realm. Could you share some of the commonalities there as well?
Yeah. Well, they usually report a sense of leaving the physical body, and then in many experiences, going to some other seemingly unearthly realm or dimension of existence where there are non-physical beings there. And some may be identified as deceased loved ones. Some may be identified as deities or angelic spirits. And many are just not identified. They just say, well, I was in the company of these other beings, but I don't know what they were. Many people will then have a life review in which their entire lives are displayed for them, where they often relive the entire life in a matter of seconds. And one of the remarkable things about the life review is that in many cases, they re-experience these events not only through their own eyes, but through the eyes of someone else that was involved in the situation. Let me give you an example of this. Tom was a fellow in his 30s who was working on his truck in his garage, and he's underneath the truck, and it's jacked up, and the jack slipped. Actually, it was his car was over a defect in the pavement, and it just collapsed, like a sinkhole developed, and the whole car creamed down, and his truck just crushed his chest. And he had a near-death experience at that point. And he said that during that experience, he relived every event of his life. And I remembered one that he remembered was when he was a teenager and he was driving down the street in his truck and an intoxicated man ran out in front of him and he jammed on his brakes to avoid hitting him. And then he rolled down the window of the truck and started yelling at the man. And the fellow, being quite drunk, reached his hand inside the truck window and slapped Tom across the face. That was too much for a hot-headed teenager. So he got out of the truck and started beating the man up. And he hit him and hit him and hit him until finally the guy was just lying in the median strip. And then Tom got back in his truck and drove away. Now, he tells me that when he had this life review, he experienced it through his own perspective, feeling the intense rage and the embarrassment of being yelled at by this drunk man, and the adrenaline rush. And then he also felt it through the eyes of the intoxicated man. He felt Tom's 32 fist blows on his face. Now, Tom couldn't have told you it was 32, but he said, reliving it through that guy's eyes, I felt them. And I felt my nose getting bloody. And I felt my teeth going through my lower lip. And he felt all the embarrassment of being beaten up by a teenager. And he said, as many near-death experiences say, I came back from this experience, realizing that we're all the same. There's no difference between me and you. We're all in this together. And this brings them to what we call the golden rule, which is part of every religion we have on this planet. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But they say, for them, it's not a guideline we're supposed to follow. This is a law of the universe. When I hurt you, I'm hurting me too. And when I'm helping you, I'm helping me too, because we're all the same. There's no difference between us.
Wow. Wow. What a beautiful lesson.
Yeah.
When it comes to the life review, the feelings that near-death experiencers share with you and your team with respect to how they feel about that life review, I'd love to hear the thoughts on that, because is it typically that they have compassion for themselves after watching the life review, even if they did some incredibly horrible things throughout their life? Or what are the general feelings and takeaways after having the life review?
Yeah, yeah. They often report that in the experience, they are judging themselves. They're not being judged by some other entity, not by God, not by anything else. There's no outside thing that's guiding them or judging them. But they are judging themselves, and they never use the word sin. They always talk about mistakes. Mm-hmm. I realize it was a mistake for me to do this. And they come back sometimes feeling bad about the things they've done. But as you said, with a lot of compassion for themselves, realizing that no one's perfect, and they themselves, having come back, are not perfect, but they know what being perfect means. And they come back with a determination to try to lead a better life than they did before.
And when it comes to people who've experienced NDEs and had the life review, is there typically a being accompanying them with a life review, or are they just automatically shown this? Does it vary? Is it kind of different across the board?
It's different. In most cases, there is another entity that's showing them the life review, but not always. And I've heard it described in many different ways. And again, this is the metaphor. How do you explain that I live my life all over again? And some people talk about flipping through the pages of a book, seeing different events. Some people seeing it like a movie, and some just report, I relived it all. I was there. And they describe in very great detail the events that they happened, the things that they couldn't have known. For example, I've had people tell me that I could count the number of mosquitoes around me that day. And I could have done it when I was there as a kid. But going back and reliving it, I could see them clearly. I knew how many there were.
Wow. The in episode 4 of my podcast, I interviewed this guy named Vinny Tolman, who had what is called an after-death experience. And from my understanding, that's a subset of the near-death experience community, but it's a unique category where these individuals have been legally pronounced dead. Can you share any insights or research into after-death experiences?
Yes, they're unusual for people actually to be declared dead, but we do have a lot of cases like that. And they don't seem to be very different from cases where someone has not been pronounced dead. This is one of the puzzles about near-death experiences, that how close you come to dying doesn't necessarily influence the type of near-death experience you're going to have.
Or the length of it, right?
That's right. That's right. And here's one of the confusing things is that we can describe the length in terms of our time. Someone was unconscious for 3 seconds or for 2 hours or for 3 days. But if you ask them about it, there was no time in this other realm. And I've talked to people who were seemingly unconscious for a few seconds, and to describe the near-death experience takes them hours to tell me about it. And they say there was just no sense of time. Everything was happening all at once. There was past, there was present, there was future, the way you describe it. But it wasn't past and present there. It was just all happening at once.
Most of our ancestors ate nose to tail, which means they consumed all parts of the animal, didn't waste really any of the animal. And that means that their diets were naturally rich in essential nutrients like collagen. And unfortunately, most modern diets are severely lacking in essential nutrients like collagen, which is why Paleo Valley made their 100% grass-fed bone broth protein powder. The term grass-fed today is thrown around pretty wildly. It can mean anything from 100% grass-fed to just partially grass-fed to minimally grass-fed and really primarily grain-fed. But Paleo Valley goes the extra mile to ensure their bone broth protein powder is sourced from 100% grass-fed cows. I have here in front of me the chocolate bone broth protein powder, and the ingredients in this are bones and water, organic coconut milk powder, organic cacao bean, organic chocolate flavor, organic monk fruit extract, and Himalayan pink salt. That's it. They also have a vanilla flavor, and they also have an unflavored version, but I am partial to the chocolate flavor. It tastes just like the chocolate milk that I used to have as a kid, except for it's not toxic. It's actually really good for you. I've been shopping with Paleo Valley for years. I've used their bone broth protein powder, their 100% grass-fed beef sticks, also their organ supplements, and I've found their products to be nutrient dense, high quality, natural, and made with integrity. So if you're ready to upgrade your health in just 30 seconds a day and get this essential nutrient collagen, head to the show notes or visit paleovalley.com/the way forward. And when you check out, a 15% discount will be automatically applied to your order. Experience the difference of truly natural, nutrient dense, 100% grass-fed bone broth protein powder and so many more incredible products with Paleo Valley. At this point in history, community is essential. And as the world shifts in ways we never imagined, finding spaces that foster true connection with like-minded people is more important than ever. Join us this year for our third annual Confluence Festival, May 7th through the 12th in Bandera, Texas. Confluence is a transformational gathering where a like-minded community comes together on a stunning regenerative farm just outside of San Antonio, offering the perfect opportunity to connect deeply with nature, paradigm-shifting knowledge, and one another. With multiple offerings running simultaneously, Confluence features a dynamic mix of lectures, workshops, live music, movement classes, and more, covering topics from circadian biology and consciousness to dome building and regenerative agriculture. Attendees are encouraged to CYOA, choose your own adventure, ensuring a truly personalized experience. This year, we are so stoked to welcome Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell, a leading neuroscientist featured in the viral Telepathy Tapes podcast series, sharing her research on the science of telepathy and expanded consciousness. Dr. Gerald Pollack will reveal his groundbreaking work on the fourth phase of water, reshaping how we understand biology and energy. We'll also be joined by Dr. Kelly Brogan, Eileen McCusick, Beta Austin, Tom Barnett, and many, many more incredible workshop leaders and lecturers. Plus, we'll have live musical performances from Lincoln Jesser, Head Flux, DJ Mike Winner, Joel Rafiti, and several other incredible musicians and performers. And when it comes to nourishment, we believe food is medicine. I promise you will not find better food at any event you attend. The full-scale restaurant on-site serves farm-to-table meals with ingredients grown and raised right on the property or sourced from local farms, providing a deeply nourishing experience for both body and spirit. And our event accommodations are designed for every comfort level. Camp under the stars, stay in a cozy tiny home, enjoy luxurious glamping, or park your RV. If you prefer a hotel, we've got you covered with nearby hotel options as well. And your whole family is welcome. Our unschooling village, led by experienced guides, provides engaging activities for kids aged 2 through 12, ensuring that parents can fully immerse themselves in the experience while their little ones learn and play in a supportive environment. Come be a part of an unforgettable event surrounded by like-minded community where we gather in celebration of health, freedom, and coherence. Visit confluenceevent.com or head to the show notes to learn more and reserve your spot today. It makes my wheels spin in my head as it relates to like how this realm works, because so much of my podcast and just exploration in this life is spent on trying to figure out how all of this fits together while also knowing at some level, and I'll use an analogy, that assuming that there is a creative force or a creator of this realm, and assuming that we have limitations, whether intentional or unintentional as human beings, in understanding that, truly understanding and grasping the creator and its creation, and possibly those two are one and the same. And now we're getting into the difference between pantheism, panentheism, but trying to figure out how all this works, I think is almost impossible, because it's like, the analogy of the only individual who truly knows the purpose of this abstract painting is the individual who painted it. And the rest of us are just trying to make sense of the painting, pointing to it and giving our interpretation of it, maybe figuring out pieces of it. Right.
Right.
But the thing that is so incredible to me is the consistencies in near-death experiences, the commonalities. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier is a lot of people experience coming across beings. And you said, many in the West would call that being God, or some would even say that it's Jesus Christ. Some of those people, and I've read the accounts, have sworn that no, it was for sure Jesus Christ. So my larger question is, and this also relates to how this realm might possibly work, is it that near-death experiences are in part being driven by that individual's belief systems in that lifetime? I know you said that they explain it through the lens of their belief system. And of course, this phenomenon many described as being ineffable. They can't articulate what it is that they're exposed to. But aside from explaining it through the lens of their belief system, is it that their near-death experience is actually dictated, at least in part, by their belief systems in this life? Have you come across any evidence of that?
That's a great question, Alec. I really cannot say that I have, because it's hard to separate the experience itself from the interpretation of it. Everything we do is influenced by our perceptions of it and our memories that we compare it with. So it's hard to separate the experience itself from your interpretation of it. Now, I will say that there are some people who are so concerned about staying in control in this life, and are so obsessed with being in control, that when they start to have a near-death experience and feel themselves out of control, they fight against it. Wow. And they do everything they can to stop the experience from happening and try to get back into their bodies and try to end this procedure at all. And some of them succeed in doing that, in getting back into their bodies and sort of abort the experience. Others have tried to fight it and eventually given up trying because they were just exhausted by it. And as soon as they give up trying to fight it, it becomes a blissful experience. Wow. So I think it's to some extent your personality can determine what type of experience you have. But I think that influence is limited. Mm-hmm.
And what about for the religious people who have experienced near-death experiences? do they typically come back with the same? And let's say in this case, I'm talking about, and I don't know if you have any data on this that is significant, but staunchly religious people that are dead certain that their specific religion is the correct religion, and then experience near death experience. What information have you gained from them?
Yeah. There are some people who enter a near death experience with some very firm religious beliefs, and they come back with those beliefs confirmed by the experience. But that's a minority. The majority of people who go into an experience come back saying, this was not at all what I was expecting. This is not what I was taught by my religion to think was going to happen. And they come back thinking that these religions are man-made ways of explaining what's really out there. And they're all just man-made. And the religions are just ways of getting you to behave better and to appreciate that we're not the ultimate. There's something bigger than us. But they're all the same, basically. It doesn't matter what religion you ascribe to. They all take you to the same place.
Another thread that I'd like to pull on is the unconditional love and unity that people experience when they have these near-death experiences. Can you touch on that? Even for, let's say, the worst of the worst, people who feel as if they've done a lot of bad in their lives.
Yeah. I've talked to people who are on death row, who are murderers, who have been in death row for decades. And they sometimes have near-death experiences that are just like everyone else's. So the quality of your life does not really influence the type of near-death experience you're going to have. Now, you may have a life review in which you relive all the horrible things you've done and feel bad about that. But you don't have a sense that you're being condemned by someone else. And you do have a sense that there's this unconditional love waiting for us there, and that everything you do will be accepted. I don't know if forgiveness is the right word, but you will be accepted for who you are and what you are. And what you are is not the bad things you've done. There's some, you can call it a soul, you can call it, I don't know what you call it, but some part of you that is beyond all the things you've done here. And that part is accepted when you go into this other realm. And people come back with a sense of being unconditionally loved. And they come back with a sense that they're supposed to try to share this with everyone else. But of course, being back in the body with our typical lives, it's very hard to do that.
In talking with Vinny, and also in talking with my friend, Dr. Edith Ubuntu Chan, who did not have a near-death experience, but she had a transformative experience doing Qigong. But both of them described that the fullness of who and what they truly are, when they did finally enter back into human form, they almost felt claustrophobic, because it's like, how can I fit the totality of who and what I truly am back into this meat suit that I'm wearing?
Yep. I've heard that from a lot of people. And often they say it's not just being back in the body, but also being back in the brain. And they say that when I was over there in this other realm, everything was perfectly clear to me. I understood the workings of everything, of the universe. But now that I'm back inside here in this flesh suit, I can't understand it at all. It doesn't make any sense to me, because all I have is a brain to understand things with. And there I wasn't limited by the brain. I had access to all information. But now that I'm back in this body, I can't understand. I can't make sense of it.
You know, that would anecdotally indicate the idea that the consciousness creates the brain and not the other way around, that we're squeezing what the totality of our individuated. And I'd love to talk to you about individuated and separateness versus oneness, but squeezing all of what we truly are back into this, having to use the mechanisms of the body in order to experience this life.
Yeah.
And that brings me to another question.
Yeah.
What do most near-death experiencers, or let me frame it a different way, is there commonalities amongst near-death experiencers in sharing, if they did receive any of this information or wisdom on the other side, so to speak, what they've come to understand is the purpose of this human experience?
So a lot of questions there, Alex. Let me try to take them one at a time.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah. No, you're talking about the brain and the mind. As animals, we evolved to survive in this physical world. And our senses do that, and our brain does that. The brain was evolved in order to help us survive and find food, shelter, a mate, avoid predators, and so forth. So what it needs to do to concentrate on that is to filter out all our thoughts and perceptions and memories that don't have to do with survival. So when you're free of the brain, like in a near-death experience or other spiritual experiences, you may have access to other types of reality, like deities and deceased loved ones, that don't help you survive in this world. In fact, they may just distract you from trying to find shelter and food and warmth and so forth. So when you come back into the body, your brain dismisses all that stuff, filters it out, and just lets you focus on what you need to do to survive in the world. So I don't think it's fair to say that the mind or consciousness creates the brain, but it's certainly limited by the brain when you're in this body. But it exists out there. There's no question in my mind that the brain does not create the mind. And this is not a new idea. Hippocrates said this 2,000 years ago. He said, the brain is the messenger or the interpreter of the mind, so that the body can survive in this world. You also talked about the sense of separation or oneness. And this is a paradox for us, because people in a near-death experience will say, I was one with God, one with the universe, one with everybody else. But I also had a sense of being a separate entity. And when I ask them to explain that, they say, well, I can't now that I'm back here in the body, but over there it made perfect sense. And again, they will use metaphors. They will say it's like a wave in the ocean. It's made of the same material that the rest of the ocean is. It's all the same thing. But for a time, it's got a separate structure as a wave. And we know that it will eventually fall back into the ocean and be indistinguishable from the rest of it. And they say that's what it's like to be a person. For a time being, you have a separate identity, but you're made of the same stuff that everything else in the universe is, and you will eventually fold back into it. In terms of the purpose of what we're doing here, most near-death experiences will say that the reason we're here is to love. And that was the message of the near-death experience, that it's all about love. And when I ask them, you say that this other realm is full of unconditional love, and this one is full of anger and jealousy and hatred and all sorts of conflict. Why would you come back to this world to learn about love when it's over there? I get different answers about this, but what it boils down to is, over there you don't have to learn how to do it. It's just there. And you need to be back in a realm where there is conflict to learn how to love despite all the conflict and the anger and the controversy that we have here.
That resonates with me so much, having had what most would consider a pretty traumatic and chaotic upbringing. I look back on those childhood experiences and I'm incredibly grateful for them. Genuinely. I'm not going to say that I always feel that. There's times where I get triggered and I get pretty upset, but overwhelmingly I'm grateful for them, because they gave me what I consider to be the necessary contrast for how this is almost ineffable itself, like how important love is, how important gratitude is, how important compassion and forgiveness and these other qualities are. So that's really cool to hear that.
There's
a few more things I want to get into. And I want to be very respectful of your time here though. And I so appreciate you joining me on this. My mind just goes so many different places. So I'm, thank you for answering three questions in one there. With near-death experiences, from my understanding, the overwhelming majority of people share that it was a positive experience. But also from my understanding, there are some who report having a negative experience. Like there's Yes. One example of a guy who I think was in a plane crash or something like this. And this is shared widely on social media, and said he went to hell afterwards and he immediately fell on his knees and became a Christian when he came back to this earthly realm. But can you just share the research you've come across with those who've had a negative near-death experience?
Yeah, sure, Alec. It's hard to do that kind of research because people are not really willing to talk about the negative, unpleasant experiences. You know, they hear all the publicity about the blissful ones and they think, well, something's wrong with me that I didn't have one of those. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to talk about it. And they also may be traumatized by the experience and not want to try to remember it. Yeah. So we find they often try to repress it and try not to think about it. But we have had people estimate how frequently those experiences occur. And some people find only 1 to 2%. Other people find as much as 20-25% of near-death experiences have at least some unpleasant aspect to them. When we try to look at what differentiates people who have unpleasant experiences from the pleasant ones, we really can't find anything, with one exception that I'll come back to. But certainly people who lead saintly lives can have unpleasant experiences. And we have records from some of the great saints in Catholic history, St. John of the Cross, and St. Teresa of Avila, who described the dark night of the soul when they had horrific spiritual experiences. And I've talked to a lot of people who lead horrible lives, who were in violent professions. One was a member of the mafia, and people who were in really cutthroat businesses who really hurt a lot of other people and yet had blissful experiences. So you can't say that the type of experience you have is related to the type of life you've led. I mentioned one exception to that, and that is, again, the people who have a very strong need to be in control. Mm. And they find that the near-death experience where you're out of control is terrifying for them. And this is a terrifying, the whole thing is frightening for them. And they don't like being there. They want to get back. And those who succeed in coming back from that often feel that it was a horrible experience unless they stayed in it long enough to get exhausted and give up. And then it becomes a blissful experience once they stop fighting against it.
Wow. Vinny shared during his near-death experience, after-death experience, rather, that when he was in the realms beyond, I think he calls it heaven, he peered into what looked like the pearly gates of heaven. So the way Vinny described it, and I'll paraphrase here, is that when you're in this realm, in order to enter into the actual kingdom of God, you have to raise your frequency to a certain level to match that. Otherwise, there's almost like an energetic barrier that you cannot pass. And outside of this barrier, there are these orbs or pearls that look just like pearly gates. And then again, this is Vinny describing. Mm-hmm. And he peered into these orbs, and there were people in them that Vinny instantaneously knew were working off their karma, so to speak. Like, for example, one guy was dressed in 1920s, 1930s, New York, Italian New Yorker garb, and was just yelling, screaming, crying at his son, just angrily yelling at his son inside of this orb. And then once he had reached the point of that experience being enough, the orb dissolved and this individual immediately knew where he was and then entered into the kingdom, so to speak. Are there any examples of sort of this, I don't want to call it a purgatory experience, but an experience with respect to near death that is someone before they can enter into the more benevolent, all-loving experience, they have to work off some of their karma? I know we have the life review, but I'm speaking specifically to this.
Yeah, that there are some, and there are people who say that it didn't happen to them, but on their way to this heavenly realm, they saw other entities, other beings who were in this purgatory state trying to deal with their quote mistakes. And I've heard other people describe things like pearly gates and, you know, beautiful cities. But majority of near-death experiences say, no, those were our metaphors. That I almost laugh, they say, when I hear people talk about pearly gates, because I know that's their interpretation of it. That there's this indescribable realm that we don't have words for here. It's just indescribably beautiful. But when we talk about it, we have to use some words to describe it. So we say what we've been taught to say, which may be pearly gates, maybe, you know, streets paved with gold. It may be nirvana. It depends on what you've been taught to use to describe these things. But this, it really is not any of these things literally. Those are just metaphors.
So modern science says that we can only perceive roughly 0.0035% of the available electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah.
Has there been any reports from near-death experiencers on where exactly this realm is? And the reason I'm saying that is because I can't know this, but I tend to be of the mindset that all of it is here and now. All of it is here and now. But again, because of the reality that we're in this vessel, we're experiencing this realm through a body with its limitations while in this reality. We simply just can't perceive some of these things that when we become disembodied, we can.
There are some people that come back and say, I am no longer limited by this body. I know I'm in it right now, but I can also experience being outside it and being part of something much greater than this body. But for most people, that's hard to do. You can remember what it was like in this other realm, but you can't spontaneously go back there. As to where it is, there are certainly many who say we're part of it. It's all around us. That this other realm is not another location. It's where we are now. It's a different aspect of what we're seeing now. But most people will tell me that you can't ask the question, where is it? Because you can only ask where something is if it's a physical thing. Only physical things have a physical location. If you're talking about a non-physical thing, it can't be anywhere. There's no location for it. It just is.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Can you share some of the examples of people who, during their near-death experience, were given foresight on something that was to occur in the future, or given special knowledge, or came back with miraculous healings? Maybe they were suffering from a disease before. I know I'm throwing a lot of different categories at you, but just some of the examples of those things that occurred just after a near-death experience.
Yeah, yeah. There are some people who say that in their life review, the timeline extended into the future as well. And they were shown or led to understand things that were going to happen in the future. And often these are things that are not very specific. They may be told that there's going to be some big disaster in your life. You need to learn how to deal with it. But sometimes they're very specific. I'll give you an example of a fellow who was living in England during World War II. And he was a child. I think he was around 5 or 6 years old. And the place was being bombed all the time. It was a very terrifying time to live. And he had a near-death experience when he was hospitalized for pneumonia. And in this near-death experience, he had visions of his future life. And he described sitting in an easy chair as an adult, and he was watching his two children, a boy and a girl, play on the ground on the carpet in front of him, and he heard his wife in another room making dinner. And ahead of him, there was a large piece of furniture that he couldn't understand what it was. Fast forward about 30, 40 years, and he finds himself now living in California, and he finds himself in that identical scene. And there he is sitting in his easy chair, and his two children, a boy and a girl, are sitting on the floor in front of him playing, and his wife is in the kitchen making dinner, and he realizes, this is what I saw when I was in England during the bombing, during my near-death experience. And the piece of furniture across the wall, across from him, was a television set, which he didn't know anything about when he was a teenager back in World War II. He hadn't heard of those things. So I have case after case of that where people have seen things in the future, sometimes seen a future spouse that they didn't know at the time. And then later in their lives, it came true just as the way they said it would.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. And what about, let's say, other special knowledge outside the realm of being able to see the future?
Yeah. Many people come back with a sense that they have an ability to heal. And it's often a vague sense. It's not a specific thing, but they feel like they can touch people and sort of take away their pain or just think kind thoughts about someone and help them heal. And some have actually set themselves up as professional healers. That's not the majority of near-death experiences. That's an unusual experience. And there have been a few studies where people have tried to measure energies coming from these people's hands. And we haven't really found anything with that yet. We've looked, but we don't know what kind of energy to look for. But we've looked at the types of energy that are easy to measure, like heat and electromagnetic change and so forth. And we haven't found anything different about these people from other near-death experiencers. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but there are some people who come back feeling that our interconnectedness, which is something most near-death experiencers say, extends also to being able to heal other people's bodies as well. Wow.
That's incredible. Remind me, you'll know, obviously, I don't remember. There's one lady who I think had some type of cancer or disease prior to her near-death experience, then had her miraculous healing upon returning. Can you remind me of that case?
Yes, this was Anita Morjani, who had this experience when she was living in Hong Kong. Her family was actually from India, but they were living in Hong Kong. And at this point, she was an adult. She was married. And she had a lymphoma, which was raging throughout her body. She had grapefruit-sized lumps in her body. And she was in the hospital being treated. And the family was told that she probably won't make it through the night. She's unconscious. She's not responsive. This is it. And that night, she had a near-death experience, and it was a very elaborate one, including life reviews that went into past lives as well, and a sense of being with this divine-like being. And when she awoke the next day, she had no evidence of cancer in her body, and she had been given up for dead by her doctors before this. There are a few other cases that I've heard also of people who had other diseases, mostly cancers, that seemed to be completely healed by their near-death experience. It's been very hard. We try to get the medical records of these people to try to document that what they're saying is true, and it's very hard to do that. In the case of Anita Morjani, for example, her records were in Chinese from a hospital in Hong Kong. We have not been able to get those. She tells me that she does have a Chinese doctor in California where she lives who has been able to get the record and confirm what she said. I haven't seen those myself. But I know other cases where we've looked at the records and it's been kind of ambiguous about whether it was all just the way they remember it. Medical records, as you may or may not know, are quite faulty in themselves. People often are reluctant to write down how badly a patient is doing. And all the details are not there that you would like to have there.
This brings up, I mean, this is along the same thread, I guess you could say, of the difficulty in getting the mainstream scientific community. I don't even know if we need to get the mainstream scientific community at this point because the people are starting to understand. And I think that's more important, but nonetheless, the mainstream scientific community to recognize the legitimacy of this phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I'll just share my two cents. I'd love to hear what you have to say. So I've heard people say that because you can't study near-death experiences in controlled settings, it must not have any legitimacy behind it, or it might not have any legitimacy behind it, or we can't verify whether it has legitimacy behind it, which is a fair point. But what I find to be incredibly ironic, because what they're indicating there is that because there is no scientific method, they're not adhering to the scientific method in studying near-death experiences. What I find to be incredibly ironic, as I said, is that as I've come to understand it, the overwhelming majority of so-called scientific research, and I would say my area of, for lack of a better term, expertise tends to be more in health sciences. The overwhelming majority of health science research does not adhere to the scientific method, and they end up making these wild claims, asserting things about the human body, about human health, and what does cause illness, what does not cause illness. But then they have the nerve to point to things like near-death experience or any so-called holistic form of health and say that they're pseudoscientific. So that's my thoughts on it. I'd love to just hear your thoughts on yeah. near-death experience and as it pertains to the scientific community.
Well, people would argue about what is good scientific research. And science boils down to rigorous observation under experience, under situations as controlled as you can have them, as you can make them. And that differs according to what you're studying. If you're studying the effect of a drug, it's easy to do controls and give the drug to somebody, give a placebo to somebody else, or give them different doses and keep everyone blind to what the doses are. And you can do a controlled study with it because you have complete control of the situation. If you're studying dinosaur fossils, you have no control over any of that. If you're studying distant stars, you have no control over them. So you can make rigorous observations, but you can't control the situations. You can't decide whether that star is going to be there tonight or not. You can't describe what condition a dinosaur bone is going to be in. You have to just make the observations as rigorously as you can. So the controlled experiment is only applicable to a very small percentage of what we call science. But most scientific research is not the double-blind controlled experiment. That's only a small portion of what we call science.
In nearly all cases with modern health systems, you're waiting months for appointments only to spend a mere 10 minutes with a doctor who quickly hands out a generic diagnosis that is likely rooted in a total misunderstanding of health and causes. And then you're offered a one-size-fits-all medication or invasive treatments with unpleasant side effects. If this sounds all too familiar, consider a different approach with the New Biology Clinic, founded by Dr. Tom Cowan, a respected natural health doctor, author, and speaker. Dr. Cowan's holistic perspective on health and wellness and a deep understanding of the true nature of health and disease sets this clinic apart. With the New Biology Clinic, it's not about quick fixes and suppressing symptoms. The practitioners take time to understand your unique story, recognizing that health is unique to the individual and that illnesses have a variety of causes, physically and metaphysically. Members of the New Biology Clinic enjoy a flat monthly fee that includes a range of valuable services like health consults as needed, practitioner-led live streams on diverse health topics, access to a members-only resource library, and multiple live group sessions every month. These sessions cover fitness, breathing integration, biofield tuning, guided meditation, EFT tapping, and much more. Unlike traditional healthcare systems that thrive on frequent visits, prescriptions, treatments, and suppressing symptoms, the New Biology Clinic's motivation is to make you healthy and keep you that way. Visit newbiologyclinic.com to learn more and use code THEWAYFORWARD for $50 off your account activation. If you're a member of The Way Forward, email hello@thewayforward.com to receive $150 off your account activation. Your journey to genuine healing begins here. Hey, y'all, I'm here with Melissa Kupsch from Remedy Academy of Homeopathy. We are so stoked here at The Way Forward to be partnering with Melissa and Remedy in order to spread the message of homeopathy across the world and also to partner on the eventual development of healing centers across the United States.
People are pretty quickly coming to realize that frequency is the future of medicine. We are witnessing the great resurgence of homeopathy right now. We're really moving away from that suppressive medical model. Whether it's for eczema, asthma, hormones, fertility, anxiety, depression, trauma, whatever it is, it all starts as energy in the person's field first. If we change our field, we can completely change our life. Our two-year academy is open worldwide to anyone who wants to become a homeopath. We've got 5 lecturers and we currently have over 500 students enrolled, which is record numbers in our field. A career in homeopathy is amazing for anyone who wants flexibility in their work and who wants to be valuable in creating this new world. We have stay-at-home parents enrolled. We have ex-medical professionals, grandparents signed up who want to learn how to heal their grandchildren and pass on that invaluable knowledge. We even have husband and wife teams. So my husband enrolled in the course with no prior knowledge of health as a background, and he is loving it.
Kylie is also enrolled as well. So my partner is, and she's so stoked to become a homeopath and to be helping to spread this message across the world.
The thing that we hear from so many of our students is, I found my thing. Homeopathy is the key. We harness frequencies from nature and we alter the field of all creations. So if anybody wants to join us or they want to know more about it, they can visit our website.
Yeah, and all that information will be in the show notes. So if you want to learn more about Remedy Academy, also Remedy Collective, also some of the homeopathic products that they have, please just head to the show notes. All of that will be listed there. So when it comes to something that is, for lack of a better term, inherently more metaphysical, or let's say all indications at this point point to it being a metaphysical phenomenon that we're dealing with here. When it comes to something like that, it's even more challenging because you brought up the dinosaur bone example. You brought up the star. We can see that. We can see the fossils in the ground. We can't see a near-death experience. We can't peer into a near-death experience. So I'm assuming that that definitely adds to the challenge as well.
Right. There are lots of things that we study that we can't perceive directly. You can't perceive love, hate. What you can perceive is the effects of these things, how it affects your body, your emotional state, your hormonal state, and your behavior. So you can look at someone's reactions and assume, oh, that person is feeling calm, or that person is feeling depressed, or that person is feeling anxious. But you can't observe and measure the feelings themselves. You can only measure the effects of them. This is also true, by the way, in subatomic physics. We can create particles that are so tiny and so short-lived that they can't be observed. So what we do is we shoot them through a bubble chamber, which is an enclosed chamber that's filled with something like liquid nitrogen. And we shoot the particle through it. Even though you can't see the particle, you can see the trail of bubbles it leaves in the nitrogen. And by analyzing the trail, the after effects, you can develop conclusions about the size and the speed and the charge of the particle. So again, you're looking not at the particle itself, but at the after effects. And by studying the after effects, you can learn about particles, you can learn about emotions, and you can learn about near-death experiences. People often say that these are just hallucinations, these are imaginations. But hallucinations and imaginations do not have the after effects that near-death experiences do. So if you're judging things by their effect, these are clearly not hallucinations. These are genuine experiences.
And you've developed, correct me if I'm wrong on this actually, you've developed what's called the Grayson scale. Can you share a bit about that?
Yes, I've never called it that. I just called it the NDE scale.
Okay, I've seen other people call it the Grayson scale.
Yeah.
Okay, so other people are giving you credit that you don't necessarily want your name on it, but I appreciate that you can be there. Yeah.
Back in the late 70s, people were starting to study these experiences, and there was a lot written about them, and there was no definition, sort of, or no criteria for deciding what was an experience and what wasn't. So I went through the literature and found about 80 different things that people said were part of a near-death experience. And I collected all these 80 items, and I gave the list to a bunch of people who claimed to have had near-death experiences. I said, which ones of these do you think are really important parts of the experience and which ones are not? And they limited the list down. And they gave that limited list back to a bunch of researchers and said, which of these do you think is an important part of the NDE and which are not? And they narrowed it down further. And they went back to the experiences and I said, okay, here's a smaller list. Which ones of these do you think are important? And I kept going back and forth between the experiences and the researchers until I had a consistent list of 16 items that could not be limited any further. And those 16 items became the NDE scale. And I gave each one a rating of 0, meaning it doesn't happen, a score of 2, meaning it definitely happens, and a score of 1, meaning partly or I'm not sure about it. So there's a total range of 0 to 32 for the 16 items. And the average among a bunch of near-death experiences is about 15. So we've used that scale now for the past 40, 50 years as a kind of a standard for deciding what is a near-death experience and what is not. And this is helpful for research to know you're studying a consistent set of phenomena, not one that's too diverse. Mm. It's not particularly helpful to apply to an individual who may say, I had this experience when my heart stopped and it had never been the same. And now I'm full of this unconditional love and I feel like I'm totally connected with God and everything's different for me, but they don't score highly on the scale. So you can't say to them, no, you didn't have a near-death experience because they were obviously transformed by this spiritual experience. So it's helpful for a group of experiences if you want to make sure you're studying the same thing. But it's not particularly helpful for an individual that you're trying to work with.
Can you share the 16 items that are on that scale?
Yeah. Some are dealing with your thought processes, like your thinking being clearer than ever before, faster than before, having a life review, this type of thing. There include emotional state, like a sense of overwhelming peace and well-being, a sense of joy, a connection with a warm, loving being of light. It includes things that we call paranormal, for lack of a better word, extrasensory perception, a sense of leaving the physical body, sometimes a sense of knowing the future. And it includes things that must be otherworldly because they can't be explained in this world. Things like encountering divine beings or religious or deceased spirits or finding yourself in another realm or dimension or coming to a border or point of no return that you can't pass and still come back to life. And as I said, very few people have all 16 items, but about half of them really is what the average is for a near-death experience.
Wow. Can you share some of the best examples, some of your favorite examples of people having something that they experience that is then independently verified in the real world? I know we covered a few examples, but I'd just love to hear your favorite examples.
Well, the one I mentioned about Al seeing the doctor flapping his arms is the one I like best because it's so easy to demonstrate. And I did get confirmation from the doctor about that. We've had lots of other cases where people have seen unexpected things in the operating room, like a nurse having mismatched shoelaces that you wouldn't have been expected to have, and that were confirmed by the doctors and nurses in the operating room. But another one of my favorites is someone who saw a deceased person that was not known to be dead. And this was at the time a technical writer in his 20s who was hospitalized for repeated pneumonia. And it was very severe. He kept having respiratory arrest where he couldn't breathe and had to be resuscitated. And this was in South Africa in the 70s. And he had one nurse that was working with him most of the time who was about his age and was quite attractive. And when he was feeling well enough, he would flirt with her. And at one point she said to him, you know, Jack, I'm going to be away for a long weekend and there'll be other nurses substituting for me. So he said goodbye to her and she sent her on her way. And while she was away for that weekend, he had another respiratory arrest and had to be resuscitated. And during that time, he had a near-death experience, and he found himself in a beautiful pastoral scene. And then he saw this nurse, Anita, walking towards him from out of a forest. And he kind of did a double take and said, Anita, what are you doing here? Because he realized he wasn't back in his hospital bed. And she said, Jack, you can't stay here with me. You need to go back into your body. And I want you to find my parents. And I want you to tell them that I am so sorry that I wrecked the red MGB. And then she turned and walked back into the forest.
Wow.
When he later woke up in his hospital bed, he had complete memory of this experience. And the first time a nurse walked into his room, he started to tell her about it. She got very upset and rushed out of the room. It turned out that this nurse that he was working with, who he knew so well, had taken the weekend off to celebrate her 21st birthday. And her parents from out of town came and surprised her with a gift of a red MGB, which he tells me was almost unheard of in South Africa back in the 70s. She was very excited about that, hopped in the car and took it for a test drive, and immediately crashed into a telephone pole and was killed instantly. And this is just a few hours before his near-death experience, when he couldn't possibly have known that she had died, wasn't expecting her to have died, certainly couldn't have known how she died, and yet he knew all these things.
Wow. This is going to be inherent speculation, but I'd love to hear just your thoughts for how that mechanism works. Do you think that we exist in a field of consciousness, and when disembodied, we can access that field, just like others who have these ESP capabilities, remote viewing, astral projection, things like this? Is it a different layer, but somewhere along the same thread as that?
It could be.
Yeah.
Let me say that for all this research, I still consider myself a skeptic and a scientist. So I stick with the data that I know. And beyond that, what it means, what the ultimate purpose of it all is just speculation. And I don't know the answer to that. You can say that we are part of this mind field, this Godhead, but these are our metaphors. They don't describe something that you can really put your hand on. I think that, many near-death experiences say to me that now that I'm back in my body, I can't understand the things that were going on over there. I remember them. I know they're real, but I can't make sense of them. And I think that is true, that our brains are not complicated enough to really understand what's really going on in the universe. Hmm. And they're not designed for that. They're designed to help us negotiate in the physical world. And if there's more than the physical world, it doesn't know how to deal with that. Hmm. So I think when we speculate about what's really going on out there in the universe, we're just using our physical metaphors for it. And we can't understand what it really is.
How has doing this research changed your life and your perception on life and death and reality?
I would like to say that it's made me less afraid of dying, but I really can't, because I was never afraid of dying. When I grew up as a materialist, I thought, when you die, that's the end of it. What's to be afraid of? You just stop existing. There's no pain, there's nothing, you just stop. So I wasn't afraid of dying. But now I'm fairly convinced that death is not the end of our consciousness. I'm not completely convinced, but all the evidence seems to be pointing in that direction for me. That I would not be at all surprised if I find myself still conscious after death. I can't say that it's that for certain, but I think that that's the way things are. And that has made me a lot less anxious about everything in life, about taking risks, about, quote, horrible things that happen. I have to see them in a different perspective, because I realize that there's more to us than just what's in this bag of skin. And then what happens to us, yes, it hurts, yes, it's painful, but it's not the end of things. And there's something much greater than this that we're all a part of.
Wow. I love that so much. Thank you for sharing that. You've referred back to now a couple of times back when you were a materialist. So what would you consider yourself now? Because this also ties back into what we were talking about with the skepticism related to near-death experience, that it's all a product of the brain, et cetera, et cetera. But what would you consider yourself now?
Yeah, good question. You know, when science evolves over the centuries, it doesn't usually throw out hypotheses, it just sort of expands them. So, for example, for centuries, we used Newtonian physics to describe what's going on in the physical world. And in the early 20th century, with the relativity theory and the quantum theory, we found that that Newtonian mechanics was insufficient for studying long distances or fast speeds or very small particles, so we needed more than that. It didn't mean that Newtonian physics was wrong. It just meant that that's relevant only for a small range or a large range of what happens in our daily lives, but it's not the whole story. I think that's true of how we approach everything, including the metaphysical, that what we call material things now, physical things now, cannot encompass all these spiritual or metaphysical things. So what may happen is that we may expand our conception of what being material means, or we may come to acknowledge that there is more to life than just the physical, and we will find ways of understanding that and of studying that. And in fact, scientists are doing that now. There have been studies of scientists in Scotland and in Belgium, in Brazil, and in the U.S. And they consistently find that about half of all people who make their career in science will say that the brain and the mind are not the same thing.
I think there is an example, and maybe a couple examples, outside of the realm of near-death experience, because I know one example, or there are countless examples in near-death experiences where people, their mind is off, or their brain is not working, so to speak, and it's verified by medical experts on site, and they still retain memories, which would imply that the memories are coming from elsewhere, and we've already touched on that. But there are other examples of people having fully functioning lives with only like a 10% brain capacity. Yeah. Things like this. So I think there's a lot of indication that what you're saying is true.
Yeah, yeah. The British pediatrician John Lorber pioneered this work back in the 60s and 70s, studying people with severe hydrocephalus, which is basically water in the brain. And some people had just a thin layer of brain outside of a huge complex of fluid in the brain. Certainly not enough brain to explain what's going on in terms of our consciousness. And yet they had normal IQs in some cases. One fellow he described was actually a PhD student in math at Cambridge who had virtually no brain activity, brain matter at all. And yet had a normal life, was married and so forth, and functioned quite well as a grad student. So it's not clear what the relationship between brain and mind is. There's also a phenomenon called terminal lucidity, in which people who have end-stage brain disease, like Alzheimer's disease, have not been able to communicate or recognize family for months or sometimes years, suddenly become totally lucid again, recognize family, carry on coherent conversations, and then they pass away. It's like in those last moments, or sometimes hours before death, the brain loosens its hold on consciousness. It stops filtering consciousness and allows this stuff to come in. I don't know how to explain this, but it's a phenomenon that we're studying.
So this is a separate category, but it relates to life and death, and obviously somewhat relates to near-death experiences possibly. What is your opinion, or have you done any research on reincarnation or claims of reincarnation, and how might that relate to near-death experiences?
Yes, I've worked a lot with Dr. Ian Stevenson, who was one of the pioneers of this type of research. And he studied about 2,500 young children who claimed to remember a past life. And these are preschool children, age 3, 4, 5. And when they first start talking, they start talking about a different life. They may say things like, you know, my other mommy doesn't cook like this. And they sometimes give specific details about the life they claim to have led before, enough that you can actually go to that place, which is often a distant location, and track down the family this person claimed to have been from and verify the things that the child has said as being really happened to that person. After Dr. Stevenson passed away, Dr. Jim Tucker started doing this research and has some excellent books about this research. They've been combined into one book called Before, which is published by St. Martin's Press, and is an excellent summary of all this research. I don't know what to make of this research. It seems apparent to me that there's something more going on than we can explain by typical brain function. These children are not making it up. They're getting it from somewhere. I don't know where. I'm not convinced that our traditional models of reincarnation are the best explanation. Dr. Stevenson himself was not convinced. He often wrote in his books a list of other possible explanations for these cases, but they all involve some type of paranormal or supernatural or metaphysical explanation. None could be explained in terms of brain function with these young children. I should mention that he never studied cases that were from adults having memories or people who regain these memories under hypnosis, because it's too easy for adults to have come up with information that they learned somewhere, they saw or heard or read, and then forget where they got the information from and then personalize it. Or people under hypnosis being sort of led to imagine things and then think they're real. But when you talk with unhypnotized children, 3, 4, or 5 years old, you don't have those complications. So we only studied young children.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. And it relates directly to my last question, and then I'd really love to hear about your book. There's a group of people that claim that this realm is a controlled realm, that point back to sort of these Gnostic texts about us living in a realm that has what's called a reincarnation soul trap. That's what it's most known as. That this experience of a life review is intended to shame you, and this experience of going through a tunnel of light is a trap to just put you right back into the reincarnation cycle, because this is a realm that is fundamentally controlled by, some will say, evil entities. Some will say like an entity that is not God, but is posing as God, et cetera, et cetera. Have you looked into any of these claims or done any research as it relates to them when it comes to near-death experience?
I wouldn't know how to begin studying these things. They're philosophy. They're not science. There's nothing about them that can be tested or proven or disproven. They're just philosophical theories or religious theories. And you can either believe them or not, but there's no way of studying them to get evidence for them.
Yeah. And I find that, thank you for answering that way, actually, but I find that a lot of the individuals who propagate this idea point to very limited examples of near-death experiences rather than the whole scope of near-death experiences in order to attempt to validate their position. And it all goes back to what you're saying there, like believing it or not. Believe it or not, but I just can't imagine why you would choose in the face of lack of evidence to believe in something like that. Yeah. But I guess we'll set that aside. So I'd love to hear about your new book. And when did this book first come out?
It came out in 2021, and it's called After. It's been published in about 25 different languages now. And unlike all my previous publications, which have been in medical journals, which are kind of dry and hard for the layman to read, this was designed for the layman. It's in plain English, and it describes most of what I know about near-death experiences. And not in a dry encyclopedic way, but following my path of from a materialistic skeptic up and through how I tested different hypotheses, how I reached certain conclusions, what conclusions I still haven't reached, and finally, the way it affects people's lives and what we can learn from that.
And what are the common ways that it affects people's lives, having had this experience or even hearing about this experience?
Yeah. People almost always describe having increased joy in life and less fear of death. Now, anyone who comes close to dying is going to have more appreciation for life, but they often feel more afraid of dying if they haven't had a near-death experience. So people who have had a near-death experience not only have less fear of death, but less fear of life, and they enjoy life more. They jump in with both feet and experience everything they can. They also describe an increased sense of spirituality. And by that, they don't mean religiosity. They often have less religiosity, but more sense of connection to other people, to the natural world, to the divine, in a sense that we're all in this together. And that's what they mean by spirituality. I've also seen people who were atheists before their near-death experience who have the same types of transformations, feel totally spiritual and connected to everything else when they come back. Along with this increased spirituality is a decreased interest in worldly things, in physical possessions, in power, prestige, fame, getting ahead. They feel like we're all in this together. It makes no sense to get ahead at someone else's expense. And these changes also affect their behavior. Some people actually change their careers. I've talked to many people who are in violent professions, either police work or military careers, who felt they could no longer hurt somebody, even when in self-defense. And they often end up changing and going into some helping profession, healthcare, teaching, clergy, social work, something like this. Not all these changes are positive. There are often some challenges coming back from a near-death experience. More often back in the 80s and 90s than now, people often think you're crazy or think you're making it up, or they would alienate you somehow. It was often very difficult for families to understand what's going on with this person, and led to breakups of families. And people often have trouble going back into their same lifestyle after a near-death experience. Things that used to be important to them no longer have importance, and they have to change how they live their lives and what they think is valuable in life. This is particularly difficult for the parents of children who have near-death experiences. They have no way of understanding why their child is so suddenly acting differently. And it's often helpful to have them talk with other families that have had a child near-death experiencer. I'm a therapist myself, and I've tried doing therapy with counseling people who have come back from a near-death experience. And I found that what's most helpful to them is getting together with other experiencers who can share what they've been through and what they found helpful and not helpful in dealing with these experiences.
Thank you so much for that. And if you'd like to purchase that book, please head to the show notes. And again, it's called After: A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. Dr. Grayson, thank you so much for your time today. As we're closing up, is there anything else you'd like to share? Anything that I missed related to near-death experiences? I threw a lot of questions at you, and you did an incredible job, and you were very patient.
You did. So thank you, Alec. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yep.